Setlist in association with 7 Digital.
This week's a guy, Piracy, and Richard Ashcroft. Welcome to Setlist, the music business podcast from CMU. I'm Andy Malt. With me is Chris Cook. Hello, Chris.
Hello there.
As ever, we're going to be looking back through some of the biggest and most interesting music industry stories of the last 7 days, or so in this case. But first, Chris, it's your birthday today.
It is, isn't it?
Recording on your birthday doesn't happen very often.
I'm glad it's ever happened. I'm very pleased with the cake you brought me. It's a nice cake.
I have got you a present.
It's an invisible cake.
I haven't got you a cake, but I have got you a present.
Okay,
I would
have preferred a cake, but anyway.
I was thinking.
You were.
I need to get Chris Cook a present for his birthday, because I'm going to see him on his birthday, which doesn't happen very often these days. And what would he like most in the world from paper chasing the 30 seconds that I have in the station, because I'm already late? And I found it. Because I found you a little notebook.
It's a notebook.
Because you like notes. But look, got a clipboard.
It's a notebook and a clipboard.
And I know one of your top 5 things in the world is clipboards.
It is, although
look at that. You can clip notes to it and make notes in it.
I don't want to be ungrateful, but it's A5. Clipboards need to be A4, don't they?
Not if you're using A5.
Well, where do you print out A5 notes to go on your A5 clipboard?
You print out an A4, you fold it in half.
Oh, is that what you do?
Yeah.
Is that what I have to do?
Or if you don't want to use the clipboard, you could just use the notepad.
I could just use a notepad. But as you rightly pointed out, I'm more interested in clipboards than I am notepad.
Yes, and it's got a nice beach scene on it because you're always going on holiday.
I went to Ibiza.
Yeah.
I was staying by the beach.
Yeah.
A hotel that had 0 customer service, but a very nice beach. They'd gone big on the beach.
That's all you need.
And had IT systems that didn't work and staff that didn't care. But to be fair, they had a very nice view. It was kind of like that, actually.
Yeah, well, it'll remind you of your
of my terrible hotel.
Time in Ibiza.
and trying to get the podcast to upload on 1992 speed internet connection.
That is exactly what I was aiming for.
I gate crashed a Spotify event in the last couple of weeks.
Did you?
Which was for developers.
You're not a developer.
Well, I wanted to know what they were saying to developers.
Right.
And I got a very nice notepad from that as well.
So well, good, you could clip it to that one.
Good use of Spotify's money. It was the first half. I assume I'm allowed to talk about it. I mean, it was really easy to gate crash.
Did you sign anything saying?
No.
Well, then fine, talk.
And they gave me a notepad.
It doesn't sound like they knew you were there.
So I could take notes. No, I had a little badge that said Chris Cook and everything.
Oh.
So they had a thing at the start.
It sounds like you might have oversold your gate crashing of this event.
Well, it was very easy to get
into. I imagined
you
barging in.
No, no. I had a bread roll in my bag,
yeah,
which was left over from lunch.
Yeah,
they wouldn't let me take a bread roll into the venue. That was the venue.
In case you threw it.
Not Spotify. It was at one of the proud gallery venues by the Thames. And apparently, you're not allowed to take bread rolls in with you for some reason.
Well, it's a very sensible policy.
But they were talking about all the data crunching they've been doing to make their discovery service better. So all of the crunching.
Well, that would be good, because their Discover Weekly playlist remains utterly awful.
Says Andy Malt. And they were talking about all the research
for me,
that they've been doing.
I think other people like it.
And it was about a 20-minute presentation. And on one level, it was really interesting. But on another level, if you wanted to be cynical,
yep,
just a little bit cynical.
My ears are pricking up.
Then you could say that they've done a year's worth of research, crunching billions of lines of data, to discover that if you put an unfamiliar track into somebody's playlist, there's a very high chance they'll turn it off, which I think we already knew.
Yeah.
But the way in which it was interesting, any DJ, club DJ, will be able to tell you, oh, when I'm doing that night at that venue, I can get away with like 5 new tracks in an evening or whatever, without losing the crowd. And most radio people, in fact, at the Great Escape a few years ago, we had Matt Deegan, radio industry genius, and Sammy Jacob, founder of XFM and various other radio ventures, talking about the Radio 1 playlist. And I remember Sammy saying that he felt that the Radio 1 playlist should have a couple more edgy, new, unknown tracks in daytime on the A-list every week.
Mm-hmm.
But then he was like, they'd lose 1 million listeners.
Yeah.
But they should do it anyway, was his point.
Yeah.
But radio people, club DJs, they sort of have that gut instinct of how many new tracks you can get away with each different type of audience without losing them. And it is quite interesting that by crunching all of this data, I think Spotify are actually being able to put some figures on that.
Yeah.
So that was quite interesting. And I got a very nice notepad. But
Not as nice as that one.
Credit where it's due, it didn't have a clip.
Exactly.
On it. Mm. So Spotify did fail in that regard. They had a poster presentation, which apparently is a thing at tech events, I have now learned.
Okay.
Which is where you get techie people to come with an idea and they have it printed out on an A0 poster, mm-hmm. and then they have like 30 seconds or something to talk through it. So it's like an elevator pitch.
Yeah, but with a poster.
Accompanied by a poster. But I have to say, most of the posters were just lots of bullet points. They were just very large documents. I was expecting all sorts of illustrations and clever infographics, and I didn't get that.
How disappointing.
So anyway, that was something that happened, actually not in the last 7 days, in the music business.
No, I mean, you've really drifted off into things that didn't happen in the last 7 days. And at one point there, you were talking about something that happened several years ago. So shall we claw it back to the present?
The last week. Something yes. very exciting did happen in the last week.
Yeah, Warner Brothers Records shut down.
Warner Brothers Records is no more. One of the frontline divisions at Warner Music in the US and the UK. But
it didn't really shut down.
It didn't really shut down.
Just dropped a word from its name.
Changed its name and got a new logo. So Warner Brothers Records, obviously, was the original Warner label.
Yeah.
It being a spin-off from the Warner Brothers film studio.
Mm-hmm.
Hence the name. Hence the logo, the WB logo.
I know it.
That you see at the end of old Warner Brothers films or
the beginning.
Bugs Bunny cartoons.
Yeah.
It's probably where you're more likely to have seen it. But the Warner Movie Company and the Warner Music Company are no longer in common ownership and haven't been for 15 years now. That's important, that it was 15 years ago that Edgar Bronfman Jr. bought Warner Music off what I think was probably calling itself Time Warner at the time.
Yeah.
I think they'd already dropped the AOL bit. That was a bit embarrassing in the end, wasn't it? Sticking AOL on their name. And they sold it to Edgar Bronfman Jr. So the Warner Music became separate to the rest of the Warner media and entertainment business. But when they bought it, they being Edgar and his mates, they got a 15-year license. I believe it was a free license, although they had just paid an awful lot of money.
Yeah.
For Warner Music. At a point at which the record industry was in disarray, so maybe it wasn't really free. But they got permission to carry on using the Warner Brothers name and that WB logo for 15 years.
Yeah. Now, I remember you.
Me.
About 2 minutes ago. Saying the fact that this all happened 15 years ago was important. Why is that?
Well, it was a 15-year license.
Yep.
Happened 15 years ago.
Yep.
15 years are up.
Mm-hmm.
They could no longer use the name.
Oh.
Warner Bros.
Yep.
There were four of them, you know. The Warner Bros.
Yeah.
Or the WB logo. Which is why Warner Chappell, the music publishing division of Warner, a few weeks ago, also had a rebrand. It didn't have to change its name.
No.
Because there were no brothers in the name.
No.
But it did have to change its logo
yep.
because their logo was the WB and then Warner Chappell written on front of it. But Warner Brothers Records had to change its name and its logo. So the name they've gone with...
Warner Records.
Is Warner Records. Yep. I wonder if they could have got away with Brothers Records or Bros Records. They could have got Craig Logan in. He does management now, I think, rather than running a record label division. Formerly off Bros
yeah.
to come and run Bros Records.
They could at least got him in so they could drop him.
So Warner Records and then a bold new logo, which is basically a circle with a bit cut off it.
Yeah.
Which apparently represents a record.
Yeah.
That's the past.
Mm-hmm.
The sun.
Yeah.
It's the present, I think.
Yeah.
Because they're based in California and it's sunny there.
Yeah.
I mean, it is very sunny there.
Yeah.
Hence why it's on fire. And then the last representation that that circle might fulfill is planet Earth, which would then mean they were ripping off Universal Music's logo.
Yeah, well, they said a globe, didn't they? They didn't specify the planet Earth. They could be planning to sell records on Mars.
Maybe that's what they're thinking, because they did say that was the future.
Yeah.
Of
the future is selling records on Mars. I mean, we need to get out of this whole solar system. People are going to need music.
So a brand new name and a brand new logo and the customary nonsense statements from Warner about the rebrand. That was one of the big, not really big, developments in the music business in the last 7 days.
No, in fact, it was just a thing that happened. Let's not talk about it.
Let's not talk about it.
It's not one of the things we're here to talk about this week.
Well, we should talk about what we're going to talk about.
Because we're actually going to be talking about the RIAA's latest moves against piracy sites and how Richard Ashcroft reclaimed his most famous song from the Rolling Stones. But first, SISAC, the global grouping of songwrite collective management organisations.
Snappy.
It's very snappy,
that. To be fair, that's my description of them, not their description.
How do they say it?
Well, they would say that they are the global organisation for author collecting societies. They wouldn't like me saying that they're an organisation for songwrite collecting societies, because actually some of their members don't do songwrites.
Right.
They do like visual art or audiovisual. But the vast majority of their members are PRS-type collecting societies, which people in that world refer to as author collecting societies.
Yeah.
That's confusing, isn't it?
It is.
Authors write books.
Yeah.
And this is about people who write songs.
Do they clip notes?
No. That's not something an author would do. Songwriter might.
Maybe if more notebooks had clipboards on them.
Authors would do it.
Yeah.
I don't think they would. But maybe a songwriter would. And that songwriter would almost certainly be the member of a collecting society that represented her or his performing rights.
Yeah.
And that collecting society, with one exception, that collecting society would be part of this global organisation called CISAC, not to be confused with CSAC.
Oh yeah, don't do that.
There's going to be a lot of confusing bits of terminology in this bit of set list. So CSAC is an American performing rights organisation for songwriters. It's
but
a small... CSAC
is the global body that represents organisations like CSAC.
Correct.
Right.
CSAC with an S, CISAC with a C. What's to be confused about?
Well, nothing. I think we've cleared that up. Anyway, so that's the first word of my sentence covered.
So we're talking about this organisation called CISAC, of which PRS and all of its counterparts around the world are members.
Yes. So CISAC has temporarily expelled Spanish collecting society SIGAI, which is, I think we are not going to get in any legal trouble for saying, is quite a bad collecting society.
So before we start dissing the Spanish collecting society further, SIGAI, some people call it SKY, but then that sounds like sky.
I always thought it was sky. I thought people wanted it to sound like sky.
But
then I always thought it sounded like someone drunkenly saying, this guy.
Oh, this guy. No, I've always thought it sounded like sky. I did once get several minutes into a conversation thinking we were talking about Sky TV and then eventually realising we were talking about the Spanish Collecting Society, which for the purposes of this podcast we will refer to as SIGAI. Now, if you...
Are we out of the first paragraph of this yet?
No, I don't think we're out of the first sentence, let alone the first paragraph. But I think we've got all of our terminology sorted now.
Okay.
Now, if you see me talk about the Song Royalties Guide...
Which you might.
Which the Music Managers Forum published, we here at CMU Insights helped produce... quite recently. The Great Escape, for definite, when we were talking about all the challenges around song royalties, I pointed out how, when it comes to collective licensing, when the music industry allows the collecting societies of the world to collect royalties, on one level, collective licensing is brilliant. There are all sorts of reasons why collective licensing makes sense, even in the streaming domain. However, it has to be said that there are some good collecting societies, and there are some rubbish collecting societies.
Yeah.
And there are some fucking awful collecting societies. And then there's SIGAI, which is the Spanish Songwriter Collecting Society, which, let's just say, has been involved in a number of controversies over the years.
Yes, we have discussed this before on the show.
So a few years ago, the Fraud Squad raided them, and that was all filmed, and it was quite exciting. And everybody thought, surely now the Spanish police...
At least not often that collecting societies are exciting. So, I mean...
To be fair to SIGAI, they did make collective licensing exciting on that day when the police raided them, and people thought that various allegations of corruption would finally be dealt with. Although in the end, only one guy went to prison. People were expecting a lot more than one person to go to prison on the back of that. And then it all calmed down for a bit, but then other grievances continued, other controversies continued. But it was last year, and this is when we last talked about it on Setlist, that the global music publishers, so the majors and the big independents who have operations in Spain, started to get much more vocal about their issues with the management and governance of the Spanish Collecting Society. Because various things had happened that they felt had taken things too far.
Yes, and SIGAI did respond to those grievances by just chucking them out.
Yes.
Not letting those companies come to the board meetings anymore.
So this was the end of 2017, and the scam of the moment, the main issue that brought all of this to a head, was a thing that has been dubbed the wheel.
Yeah.
And so this is, I don't know whether we have to say alleged, but let's say alleged just to be certain.
Cover our back.
This is an alleged scam involving certain
treading
people.
Treading carefully where I refer people back to the beginning of this.
So this was an alleged scam, as I say, that certain members of Sagai were screwing with the way that TV royalties were paid.
Yeah.
And basically, the allegation was that certain members of Sagai and certain people in the TV industry were in cahoots. Some people would say, actually, certain people from the TV industry in Spain took over the society, set themselves up as music publishers, got themselves voted in, and then in essence took the society over and made all the existing problems worse. And the allegation was that because you had Sagai members and TV people in cahoots, these TV people were putting out programs that had music controlled by the Sagai members who were part of this scam, and then they were putting out the programs that contained this music either overnight when nobody was watching, or it was also alleged that they had synced that music into certain TV programs but then turned the music down to zero in the program, inventing the silent sync, which is brilliant, so that these Sagai members could say all these programs were going out containing my music. Either the music turned down to zero or the program's going out overnight when nobody was watching. And therefore, they could say, so my music accounted for 33% or whatever of all TV music output. So of all the money the broadcasters have paid in, I should get X percent of that.
Yeah.
Was the alleged scam that was occurring. As I say, it was by no means the first controversy involving this society or the first allegation of corruption at this society. But the publishers, and indeed plenty of songwriters who are also members of this organisation, were trying to get the board of the society to stop this from happening and to become much more transparent about how money was being shared and whether or not any of these deals were occurring. And it was felt that the board and the managers of this society were doing nothing to deal with these issues. And as you say, actually, their solution was to just lock out the global publishers who were shouting about this and try and carry on without them, even though they were still representing all of the songs, including the Anglo-American songs, that were in those publishers' catalogues in the Spanish market.
Yeah, so those global publishers, they lobbied CISAC to act on this and do something about it. They also started looking for ways to license their music elsewhere, which threw up a lot of new questions.
Yes, when the publishers started saying that if Sagai didn't start sorting these things out, or if CISAC didn't start forcing Sagai to sort these things out, they would look for other ways to license their repertoire in Spain. That poses the question, well, what does that mean? Are they talking about just their Anglo-American repertoire? Because generally speaking, the publishers have more control over their Anglo-American repertoire than their continental European repertoire, just because of the way rights are structured in different countries. And were they suggesting that they would start to do direct licensing into Spain? So there has been some direct licensing, obviously, in the streaming space with Anglo-American repertoire. Could they conceivably do that into broadcast or into live? Probably not. There was also the issue that even with Anglo-American repertoire, ultimately the performing rights sit with PRS in UK and SOCAN in Canada and so on and so forth. So it wasn't quite clear what that meant. Although it has to be said, as a result of some European law that went through a few years ago, which is now properly kicking in, we are starting to see some changes in collective licensing around Europe, in the way societies are regulated, and also in those countries where previously a society had something like a monopoly over the rights of songwriters based in those countries. That is changing, and we're starting to see some new collecting societies emerge, particularly in those countries where the legacy society has a bad reputation. So therefore, when the publishers started saying, we'll look for somewhere else to license our rights, probably the main assumption was they were thinking, we'll either go and find or, if necessary, set up another collecting society in Spain to do the licensing, particularly of Anglo-American repertoire. But we never completely got to the bottom of what it was the publishers meant when they firstly said, we might start looking for alternative ways to license our repertoire. And then ultimately, next step said, we now are pursuing other ways of licensing our repertoire in Spain.
CISAC, attempting to calm the situation in April last year, made a number of recommendations for reforms that should be made at Sagai and put the company on notice, saying, we'll act further if you don't enact these reforms we think you should make.
CISAC do have a code of conduct for their members. And I suppose just to explain, the reason why in some ways that code of conduct is important is because traditionally, collecting societies only really issued licenses in their home country. That has changed, particularly in the digital space in more recent years. But the traditional model was each society would only license rights in their home country. But obviously, songs get used globally, so societies were all joined up through things we call reciprocal agreements, so that the Spanish society wasn't just representing its members' rights. In Spain, it was representing the rights of all the other collecting societies around the world in that market. Which is why it's important that CISAC both has and enforces a code of conduct, because it's not just SAGAI's members who are suffering because of all of this incompetence. The members of loads of other collecting societies around the world are also suffering if their music is being used in the Spanish market, because in all sorts of licensing scenarios, they are reliant on the local society to do the deals, collect the money, and pass the money on. So that's why it is important that CISAC has a code of conduct and enforces it. That's what it started to do. It's quite a slow process, but it did then get to a point where CISAC were basically saying, okay, we gave these recommendations, we're not seeing any progress, we are now considering sanctions, and that might include kicking you out of the organisation entirely.
Which is what's now happened. Last week, CISAC put out a statement saying that while it did actually welcome changes that had been made by SAGAI's new president, Pilar Jurado, but said that she hadn't gone far enough, and therefore they were temporarily suspending SAGAI's membership.
Yeah, so it is worth noting, having completely slagged SAGAI off through most of this section, that there have been some changes at the society. They are also under pressure from the Spanish government.
Yeah.
And those new European laws I mentioned earlier actually better empower governments in European countries, in EU nations, when it comes to regulating collective licensing and the collecting societies. So they are under pressure from the Spanish government to make some changes as well. So I think what CISAC was saying was, we've got some new executives in the organisation. They are talking about making some good changes, but those changes are yet to be voted through by the SAGAI General Assembly, they call it. And so they were basically saying, even though it looks like things might be moving in the right direction, we're going to expel them anyway, albeit on a temporary basis, and we'll wait and see. A, whether or not these proposed changes get voted through. B, if they then start to get implemented. And C, whether or not they'll deal with all of the issues that CISAC has already raised. And until they see those things happening, they will not be part of CISAC. This all happened at CISAC's, basically their annual general meeting, which was happening in Japan this year. And they issued some statements confirming all of that.
Yeah, they said, today's vote to proceed with the sanction of a one-year expulsion follows an in-depth analysis of recent reforms set in motion by SAGAI's new president, Ms. Pilar Jurado. While a number of welcome changes have been proposed, they have not yet been approved by the SAGAI General Assembly. Further important technical work and changes are needed and expected by CISAC to ensure SAGAI's compliance with the Confederation's professional rules for member societies.
Officially, it's a one-year expulsion, although they did say that if the board of CISAC think at any point that SAGAI have made enough moves to deal with the issues and to make the reforms, then they could let them in before that year is up. But quite a big development, really, because it's not often that CISAC make moves of this kind.
No.
Whether or not we will now start to see the changes at the Spanish society that everyone thinks that there needs to be, and whether or not those reforms now will placate the big global publishers, or whether they have already found alternative licensing options and will continue to pursue with that, all remains to be seen, I guess. But it is quite a big development in a long, long-running story because, as I say, this all predates this scam with TV royalties and the publishers shouting about it last year. Issues with the Spanish collective licensing system go back years, and it will be interesting to see if finally anything happens to fix those issues.
Still to come, Richard Ashcroft's 22-year battle to make any money at all from Bittersweet Symphony. But now, the Recording Industry Association of America, the RIAA, just everyone knows my opinion on that abbreviation by now.
It reminds me, as this podcast goes out, I will be on my way to Cannes for this
holiday.
Year's Me Dem, working hard.
On the beach.
By another
you can
beach.
Prepare by looking at that picture of a beach.
It is true. Not sure the Cannes beach is like that. But this time last year when I was going to Cannes, I interviewed the outgoing CEO of the RIAA.
Yeah.
And in the podcast before I went out there, you were slagging off the name of this organisation.
Well, I was lobbying you to tell him what we thought of.
And said that my first question should be, why have you got such a terrible name?
Yeah.
The RIAA are back in the news.
Yes, and once again, we've completely derailed the first sentence of a section. But whatever, that organisation this week has been very busy making new moves against online pirates, because the fight is never over.
Now, a couple of developments in terms of the American record industry's attempts to get piracy operations off the internet. The first of which relates to stream ripping, which kind of remains the record industry's top piracy gripe of the moment. Obviously, there are plenty of websites out there where you can put a YouTube link or a Spotify link or whatever into a little box, press a button, and it will give you an MP3 to download of what was originally a stream. I know this because, remember a couple of weeks ago, we had the Mega Upload special, and I snuck in the Mega Song at the end, just to annoy you. In order to get the Mega Song, I had to put the YouTube link into a stream ripping site to download it. Not quite sure.
Are they going to sue you personally now, or CMU?
What copyright rules were being broken there? Kind of ironic to aid a podcast all about copyright. But whenever you do some stream ripping these days, you will quite often find that the website you used last time is no longer there. Because on the quiet, the record industry has been forcing a number of the big stream ripping sites offline. Obviously, they had the legal battle with YouTube MP3, which was one of the biggest stream ripping sites a couple of years ago. Ultimately, persuaded the guy who ran that to shut it down to avoid any more litigation. And since then, almost on the back of that, they have been approaching lots of stream ripping sites saying, if you don't shut down, we will sue you for infringement. And as is always the way with piracy operations, some sites say, we don't care, see you in court, and we're in a country where it's really hard for you to sue us. But others do say, do you know what, life's too short to be fighting litigation with the record industry. We'll shut down. So we have seen a number of stream ripping sites disappear, but there are plenty of others out there, and of course, new ones also appear. So it is kind of an ongoing process. And the latest development was they're trying to identify some people involved in some stream ripping sites, presumably so they can send those stern legal letters.
Yeah, so the latest one was a website called Y2Mate, and in the battle against that, the RIAA secured subpoenas against name registrar Namecheap and the internet services company Cloudflare, seeking to identify the people who operate that site, basically asking those companies to give up the account information so that they can track the people down and send them some stern letters and probably court summons.
And ready to be seen whether or not Y2Mate fold once that correspondence arrives. As I say, some sites do just shut down, but there are others who are up for the fight, usually if they're based in a country where actually it's quite hard work for the American record industry to pursue litigation. So it remains to be seen whether or not that name registrar or Cloudflare do indeed hand over that contact information. They probably will. Then what does the RIAA do with that, and will that site fight back?
But it's not all about stream ripping. I mean, we're yet to see if any of that stuff comes to anything. But something that has come to something is last week also the RIAA had reason to actually celebrate, because it forced a whole file sharing site offline with the help of the IFPI and Music Canada.
Yes, this wasn't a stream ripping site. This was a file hosting platform that
old school.
Old school did a very good job of hosting lots of copyright infringing music and movie content. And then there were forums out there that then linked to the infringing content sitting on websites like this. They'd actually subpoenaed the contact information of the person running this site a few weeks ago. We knew that they were seeking that information. And then shortly after, we saw the court document which was demanding that Cloudflare hand over the information about the people involved in this site, which was called dbr.ee. That was the name of the offending website.
And we can comfortably give out the URL because it's not there anymore.
It's not there anymore. So they got the court order telling Cloudflare to hand over the contact information. We knew that. That website then went down, but we didn't know for certain that those two things were linked. We thought they probably were. But it was last week when a new holding page appeared on that URL, basically saying, this website doesn't exist anymore because of copyright infringement. Copyright infringement is bad. It could be a criminal offence. Stop doing it. And here's a link to a website that will give you some legal digital music services.
Which I don't think is what people go to that sort of site for.
Well, they can have it, even if they don't want it. You mentioned RFPI Music Canada. We think the reason why the other trade bodies were involved because it probably turned out that the guy who ran this site was based in Canada. So RIAA got on the phone to their counterparts north of the border.
Said, look, we'll give you a logo on a page if you give us a hand.
Go and shout at these people. So IFPI confirmed that the person running the site had voluntarily agreed to shut it down and to never infringe a copyright again. And then that holding page has appeared. So it does seem that the RIAA is on a bit of a push at the moment to try and get piracy sites or sites which could be accused of piracy offline. I mean, they're always doing that on the quiet, but there does seem to be a particular flurry of activity from the anti-piracy brigade in the US record industry at the moment.
Yes. And while the RIAA can definitely claim a battle victory here, it's still a war that seems very much unending.
It is the whole whack-a-mole thing, isn't it? That because you get these sites taken down, but new sites keep appearing all of the time. It is tricky. Obviously, here in the UK and a number of other countries too, you also have the web blocking thing. So where there are websites that you can't get offline, even with the threat of litigation, you can try and block them. Although there are two issues there, which is that A, web blocking is not available in the US yet. And even where it is, of course, often a simple Google search will get you past the web blocks. So there is still that challenge of trying to persuade slash force the Googles of this world to not be linking through to any sites that have been web blocked by a court of law. So yeah, the battle is never ending, but at least one little victory in the last 7 days.
And finally this week, another victory. This one for Richard Ashcroft.
And we don't even need to explain how you say that.
No.
It's Richard Ashcroft.
Yeah, he doesn't abbreviate.
He of the Verve.
Yes, indeed. And this relates to a song he wrote for the Verve back in 1997. It was last, I think it was November. It was late last year, anyway. He was promoting his new solo album and giving a series of increasingly bizarre interviews while he was doing that. And in one of those interviews, he went on quite a lengthy rant about how he was coming for the money he felt had been stolen from him in relation to the song Bittersweet Symphony, which has a very strange and complicated history.
I think we talked about it on Setlist while he was doing that spree of interviews, because I seem to remember as relatively recently going through what happened in the late 90s that meant that what is, I think, unarguably the most famous Verve song and therefore Richard Ashcroft's most famous song, although the recording rights sit with the label to which the Verve were signed in the 90s, the copyright in the song that should belong to Richard Ashcroft and his publisher ended up with the Rolling Stones and their publisher.
Yes, so let's do a little, although I think we've covered this before, it's worth covering once again, because like I say, it's a very strange and complicated history. Basically, back in 1997, the Verve recorded a song called Bittersweet Symphony, which contained a 4-second sample of a cover, an instrumental cover of The Last Time by the Rolling Stones, recorded by the Andrew Lou Oldman Orchestra. The publishing rights for that song were owned by former Stones manager Alan Klein through his company Abco. So therefore, they needed to get a license from Abco in order to be able to release the song. Unfortunately, through some sort of clerical error, no one had actually done this before they'd pressed up all the CDs. So they ended up in a poor negotiating position to start with, topped off by the fact that Alan Klein was vehemently against sampling and traditionally did not ever license samples. Although in the end, did allow a license for that song, but on the condition he got all of the publishing rights.
Yeah, that was the deal that the Verve and their record label and management were forced to do. Even though, in a weird kind of way, although that 4-second sample of that instrumental version of the Rolling Stones song was in the recording, and obviously is a significant part of the recording.
Yeah.
If you remember that track, obviously the orchestral bit at the start is very important to the track. Although, in a weird sort of way, isn't part of the song. And I remember in the years after this first happening, sort of being of the opinion, well, without that little instrumental sample at the start, that's not really a good song, so maybe I understand it. But then I once heard Richard Ashcroft do an acoustic version of the song,
yeah,
which obviously doesn't have the sample because it can't. It was him on his guitar. And I personally think the song stands up.
Oh, it does.
Without that sample, it's a really good song. And
well, that's not the only odd thing about this. I mean, it's a 4-second sample that caused him to lose all of his publishing rights in that song.
But crucially, the publishing rights, it would have made more sense had it been the recording rights, because it is an important part of the recording, but not an important part of the song. But the label who released the track retained the copyright in the recording. They had sorted out the recording rights in the sample.
Yeah.
So it was all about the song. But yes, because Alan Klein basically had the band and their label, well, he could demand whatever he wanted because they'd already pressed the CDs. What were they going to do? So yeah, the deal that was done was that 100% of the copyright in the song Bittersweet Symphony would basically be split between Mick Jagger and Keith Richards of the Rolling Stones. And then because he was their publisher, that would mean that his company would publish the song outright.
Yes. Now, that meant that Mick Jagger and Keith Richards were then also credited as the writers of the song, which, as I say, there are a lot of strange things about this. They obviously, that was the deal that was done. But that string sample is from this Andrew Loog Oldman orchestra recording of The Last Time, a string part that doesn't appear in the original Rolling Stones version, and that therefore Keith Richards and Mick Jagger had no part in at any time in their lives, and somehow resulted in them being credited as writers of this song they didn't write either.
And it also meant that when Richard Ashcroft was doing that acoustic version, which also didn't have the instrumental bit that Keith Richards and Mick Jagger weren't even responsible for in the first place, the royalties that would be due for Richard Ashcroft performing that song wouldn't have gone to Richard Ashcroft. It would have gone 50% to Mick and 50% to Keith. So it was a weird turn of events because of some licensing issues back in the 1990s, the moral of which is never press CDs before you've got all of the rights in place.
Yeah.
Because Ashcroft and the Verve and all of their people would have had a much, much stronger negotiating hand to sort of stand their ground and get a more reasonable deal had the CDs not already been pressed.
So you can see why that might have annoyed Richard Ashcroft, not least because Abco then, once the song was out, just licensed it for everything. Even when the band had said, look, this is getting overplayed now, could you stop doing it? They were like, no, going to make as much money for Mick and Keith as possible. I mean, Mick and Keith even got nominated for a Grammy for that song, even though they had no part in it whatsoever. And it's the Verve's most famous song. And through the over-licensing of it by Abco, it has brought in a lot of money, which Richard Ashcroft has never seen any of, which is why, in this interview last year, he ranted at length about it and was saying that since Alan Klein had died and his son had taken over the company, he was now going to come for his money, claim back his... Well, he was suggesting that he was going to claim back all the money that had been earned over the last two decades, which I don't think that's happening. But, I mean, it seemed like an outlandish thing that he was saying in a sea of outlandish interviews.
Yeah, so it seemed outlandish that he would even get any future revenues, let alone the revenues that had gone before.
But he has. He's done a deal with Mick and Keith. He's getting his royalties now.
It was an interesting statement that was put out confirming all of this. They managed to make it coincide with Richard Ashcroft getting a Lifetime Achievement Prize at the Ivor Novello Awards.
Yes.
So Richard Ashcroft was very much in the spotlight already. And so a statement was issued as those awards were happening, saying that a deal had been done and that although Richard Ashcroft's management, after Ashcroft had made this declaration that I'm going to get my money, had been advised by lots of people in the industry, well, you can try calling up Mick and Keith's people, but we don't think this is going to happen. They basically said, as soon as we got on the phone, Mick and Keith were like, yeah, whatever.
Yes, well, the exact quote was they immediately, unhesitantly and unconditionally agreed to hand back both the writing credits and future royalties to Richard Ashcroft, which was very nice of them. In fact, the statement went really overboard.
How brilliant they were.
In saying what brilliant people Mick and Keith are and how nice they'd been to do this and how brilliant it was of them, which can only really mean that was part of the agreement, was that you will not disparage Mick and Keith in any statements you make about this. And also, we want you to be very nice about them. Because, I mean, it is quite nice of them to say, all right, you can have that back.
But they could have done it in 1998. Yeah. Well, 1997
yeah,
even.
They could have done it. They could have, yeah, could have just like immediately said, well, we think this is stupid. You just have the money. But they didn't. They spent 22 years going, yeah, we'll just take all of this money for a song that we did not have any part in.
It also meant that a lot of the reporting around Richard Ashcroft winning this Ivor Novello Award was how great Mick Jagger and Keith Richards are, which was kind of them stealing his moment in the limelight. Also, when you went down the statement that was issued about this, there were then some ambiguities about what exactly had been given back.
Yes.
And some slightly weirdly worded statements. So, for example, it said that Jagger and Richards had agreed that, to the extent it is within their power, to give Richard Ashcroft his song back. And there were some other slightly ambiguous things they were saying, which makes me think. Now, we did try and get clarity on this.
But we did not get it. the people were not responding to further questioning about this story.
I probably went back with too many copyright questions, as I usually do. And they didn't.
Well, we both went back.
They didn't come back to us with clarity. But I suspect that what has happened is that Alan Klein's company will continue to publish the song and therefore take the publisher's share of any money generated by it. But that the songwriter's cut, which means two things. It will mean the money that would be paid directly to the writers through the collective licensing system, so through PRS in the UK, plus any royalties that the publisher is due to pay to the writer, that the writer's share of this song will now go to Ashcroft instead of Jagger and Richards, because that is what they would have control over. So we don't know that for certain, but as I say, the way it was slightly ambiguously stated makes me think that Alan Klein's company will still publish the song and therefore still get the publisher's royalties on this, but that the writer's royalties from this point onwards will go to Richard Ashcroft. So, well, obviously the serious money for this song all came in 20 years ago.
Yeah.
But we should all play on the streaming services and on radio stations Bittersweet Symphony, which is still a magnificent song.
Yeah.
And a great recording. And maybe this time Richard Ashcroft will see some of that money.
Yes, although perhaps not as much as he would like, but something is better than nothing. And also, there's the fact that it's now credited solely to him. He doesn't have to share his credit with Mick Jagger and Keith Richards, who, let's state again, had no part in that song.
So a nice happy ending. We'd play out with that song to earn him some money if we were a licensed podcast, but we're not.
Yeah.
So no one would get paid and we would be infringing copyright. But people can think of it in their heads.
I don't think that earns royalties either.
Not yet.
Not as far as I know.
Not even with the new European Copyright Directive does that count. But rather than having the mega song stuck in your head for the rest of the day, you can have Bittersweet Symphony stuck in your head.
I'll take that.
For the rest of the day.
And then maybe I'll send Richard Ashcroft a check.
For having his work echoing around your brain. Although, I'm pretty sure that what is now echoing around your brain is actually the 4-second sample, which is the one bit yeah. to which actually probably he isn't deserving of
it
any money.
It is playing on a loop. It has been playing on a loop all through this in my head. It's been soundtracking this whole section and probably will continue soundtracking the rest of the day. But anyway, we can't hang around for me to tell you if that happens because we've run out of time. That is all we have time for this week. Do please subscribe, rate, review, and tell all of your friends to do the same for this show specifically, not just in general. And that would be great if you could all do that. Setlist is the music business podcast from CMU. It's presented by me, Andy Malt, and Chris Cook. It's produced by Matt Peaty. It's edited by Jason Wolfe. And for more on CMU, go to completemusicupdate.com.
Recorded at unique facilities, Setlist is an unlimited production.